Hello, everyone. I'm Louis Vargas, and you're listening to episode 53 of the Art Scene Podcast. Back on the podcast is Oakland-based artist and member of the New York art collective, Musée Cissé. Today, you'll hear us catch up and discuss the various projects he's worked on since he first came onto the podcast 3 years ago. We also discuss his newest project, Cut Trees, which is part of a series of commissions at SF MoMA titled Bay Area Walls. But before I play our conversation, I wanted to tell you about some things going on in the Bay Area. Galleries are starting to reopen, so check out places like the Minnesota Street Project in San Francisco and Part 2 Gallery in Oakland, who are open by appointment only. Some museums are also open, such as the DeYoung and SF MoMA, each of which have new exhibits on display. Others, like the Museum of African Diaspora and the Berkeley Art Museum, are still offering virtual exhibitions and programming, so please be sure to visit their website. Okay, now here's my conversation with Musée. Hey, how's it going, man?
It's going okay. Good. Very hectic right now.
Yeah, I figured, I was out on paternity leave for the last 6 weeks, and so
congrats.
Thanks. And then when I get back, I found out that you're gonna have some work showing at SF MoMA.
Yeah.
How's that going along?
I just have to do some work on the painting itself before it gets picked up tomorrow. And it's also the last 2 days of the show, so a lot of people's been coming through, and I was just with a bunch of people, not all at once, but with just a bunch of different groups of people talking about the show,
right?
They were coming in and
wanting to meet you.
Yeah. Well, I was just there, so I ended up in, you know, not doing the work that I wanted to be there for, but you know, talking to people that were coming to see the show, which was nice.
Yeah.
Just.
Well, I mean, you have a lot going on, like right now, right? Like this is like. This year, I mean, pandemic be damned.
Yeah.
You know, you're still busy.
Yeah, definitely still busy. It's been a weird time. A lot less busy.
Yeah.
Now that the work is like up and hung, and I'm just doing some last minute stuff. And
yeah. Well, I mean, overall, how has the pandemic been? Like, was when everything kind of shut down? Was it? Like, did you even at all feel like a pause that a lot of us did, or you were just like still? Just,
oh, of course.
Yeah. How long do you think that lasted before you were like, okay, let's just get on it. Like, we still need to keep going.
I mean, art making is really like ingrained with my life. Yeah, it was like just a matter of trying to get the train back on the tracks in a way.
Yeah.
So like things were getting canceled. And things were changing.
Yeah.
I was still working on a show for the San Jose ICA, which was going to open. And then I finished the work for it, and it didn't end up. I mean, it's up right now, but it still hasn't been able for people to come see it.
Yeah.
But, like, since March. But then, yeah, I kind of was working on a show for Part 2 LA, and then that didn't work, and you know that space fell through, and they Part 2 had to get rid of it. It was losing too much money.
Yeah.
And so then my show was kind of up in the air, and Brock suggested to take the August slot here at Part 2 Oakland.
Yeah. And Brock Brake.
It's a much bigger space.
And Brock Brake, the co-founder of Part 2, right? Part 2 Gallery.
Yeah. And since the show moved to the Oakland spot, which is a lot bigger, I decided to do the two separate solos. There are two bodies of work.
Yeah.
So one was continuing the theme that I was going to do in LA, which was Freetown Veranda. And then the show Purest Air I've Ever Known. That was something that I wanted to do that was more responsive to the moment.
Yeah.
Well, I was gonna we'll get to those because I want to ask you about that one too, in particular, because I've been very intrigued by that, the work in that show. But it's a little bit different, so I was like, I wanted to ask more about that. But before yeah. I get to that, I wanted to like at least catch up on other stuff, because I feel like it's been 3 years, I think, since I first had you on, and which feels like it feels like a lifetime ago, because I feel like in those 3 years you've so much, like you've done so many things. Like you've had, I mean, at that time we were talking about Domestic Drive, which was the first solo show at mm-hmm. Part Two. I think you even did another show, a solo show, Skeletons, which was a hit too. And somewhere in between, you even worked, you did work for Project Backboard, right? Which is that nonprofit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, doing like mm-hmm. where you refurbished, like they were refurbishing blacktop basketball courts, and you like did, you painted one of them.
Yeah.
So that was really great. Yeah, right?
That was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was awesome. I mean, I'm a big basketball fan.
Yeah. How did you get connected with that project?
It's one of those serendipitous kind of things. Well, not really, maybe not serendipitous, but I had seen the stuff that they were doing in like 2000, like when they first started in like 2015 or 16, like really kind of early, well, maybe 16, 17. I had just been aware of them, and I had just come off of like working with the Arts Commission and like interning there. So I got into contact with them because I was actually trying to connect them to San Francisco, the city, through the SFAC, to help renovate the court in San Francisco, because San Francisco, I forget the measure that passed, but you know, it was that one where they've been remodeling the parks for the past like 6-7 years.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
So it was like in conjunction with that, so I was like, oh, like I knew SF had this allocated budget to redo the park. So I actually was just trying to connect them together. I wasn't even trying to connect them to my personal work.
Wow.
I was just trying to get them to do something in the Bay with anybody. So that actually didn't end up working, because I don't really think, like, SFAC is not just equipped to take random suggestions and make it happen.
What a very politically correct way to put that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, but basically they didn't listen.
Right, politics at the end of the day.
So I was like, okay, you know, whatever. Like, I was like, your loss. This is, I thought it was kind of cool, and I thought it would be like a really nice addition to the parks in SF.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess Dan Peterson, the guy from the guy who runs Project Backboard, we got connected via that, and you know, yeah, we had just been talking like randomly throughout the, you know, the past like 4-ish years maybe, maybe even more, 4 or 5 years,
right?
And you know, like later on, he was just like, oh, you know, like, I really, like, you know, he saw my work. He was like, really, he dug it. He's like, actually, an old geometry teacher.
Yeah.
So he, like, you know, kind of connected to the geometric aspects of my work. And then he was like, oh, you know, you should do something together. And, you know, how many times did you hear that? So I was like, okay, yeah, whatever, you know, I'll love to do something anywhere. And then out of the blue, he hit me up and was like, hey, like, we finally got some opportunity to do something in Oakland. Do you want to do it? And I said, of course. Yeah. It was great. Like, I, you know, wanted to do something. I was even talking to him about doing something in LA, or because I know LA has just like kind of like an endless amount of outdoor basketball courts. But yeah, he found something here, and it, you know, it was really a really great project. You know, it was connected to the It was connected to the the reconstruction of this whole youth center, youth rec center at Rainbow Rec. So it was like part of this big project. So the court was kind of like the icing on the cake, and then, you know, it's for kids. It was like primarily for kids.
And that's in Oakland, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we had been, before we finished it, because we finished it last summer, I had been working with him on that specific project a whole like year and a half before that.
Oh, really? It was that long?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So now that I think about it, I probably have known him for like kind of a while, because I got the project in 2018.
Oh.
And I actually met with the kids and had a workshop with the kids before they demolished the old building. I've been, you know, involved with the process throughout the whole construction of the rec center. And yeah, it was a really smooth project. It was good. And funny that happened. I started that the day after I opened the skeleton show.
Really?
So that was like really, yeah. So that was like back to back.
You know what's even funny about how I even found out that you did that? I don't even think it was by word of mouth or anything like that, or even Instagram. So like the old person that I am, not that I'm old, but like I was watching 60 Minutes, and they did like the last 2 minutes of like the episode. They were like, "Oh, we just want to talk about this new project called Project Backboard." And then they're talking to the guys, you know, to him, and they're like, he's talking about how great this program is. And then you appear for like a second. And I was like, what? That's Muse. And that's how I found out about it. And I had to like ask around. I'm like, what is this? Like, what? Like, and then that was it. Just like for like a minute, you were like on 60 Minutes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I was like, did Muse just like hit it big? Like, wait, what? Like, what just happened? And then, like, I think, like, within like a couple, like a month or whatever, you were Skeletons was opening, and I was like, oh, and then I kind of just like put it in the back of my mind, because I was like, maybe I'm mixing the two things. Like, maybe I'm just kind of like, maybe it was something about Skeletons, and I just don't know. Like, you know, it was one of those things where it happened so quick. And then like someone confirmed, a mutual friend of ours, Adrian Martinez, confirmed it, where I was like telling him, I thought I saw almost 60 Minutes. He's like, no, you did. And I was like, okay, so that was big. It was a big project.
They also like, what is it? Like Gayle King's show, you know, that like newscaster.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oprah's best friend.
They like,
she
didn't come through, but like it was like on her show.
Wow.
And like, yeah, they sent like a news team to the gallery and just like interviewed me for like the CBS news.
That must be they must have just replayed the same clip, because 60 Minutes is a CBS show.
Probably.
That's crazy. Well, I mean, how did you feel about that? Like, how was that for you, right? Like, to have, like, all of a sudden there's, like, a news crew coming through.
Oh, whatever. I don't really, it was fun. I don't really, like, think too much about those things, you know? I was happy that they came, like, for the basketball court, but they filmed it in the gallery. They came into my studio, and I was like, hey, look, I have a show up right now. And they're like, what? And I was like, yeah, this is what I do when I'm not painting basketball courts, I guess. So it was cool because they filmed part of the interview in the gallery. So I was really excited to get to show the paintings to the news audience, I guess. I don't know. People who watch the news.
Well, like, you know, as a career artist, like yourself, like, what do you find, and maybe it's equal but for you, but what do you find more value in? Like, is it doing those types of projects, or is it the being able to like continue to produce work and like have a show? Because you know, now you have like your third solo show. Well, I guess it's a maybe third and fourth, right? Solo show. Yeah. Third and fourth solo show.
Yeah.
And so like I wonder, in terms of for you, like what does it mean more to like get to be able to do public projects like that and give back? Or is it more, you know, doing like that's cool, but like really what you like is just being able to continue to have your space and make work and show it? Because you have like that sociology background, which I always think about with you, right? Yeah. Because you have a different background than a lot that most artists don't have, right? Most artists like go to like fancy art school, maybe art school. An MFA, mm-hmm. right? But you don't. Like you majored in something completely different.
I mean, it's just like, even though I'm like a, I guess a career artist, it was never, I still don't really think of it like that. And I think there's a bit of still maintaining this, like, not taking it too seriously in terms of, it's kind of complicated the way I think about art. It's kind of this like inevitable thing in my life that is like very definite and solid. And, you know, I think there is doing projects in the community, like murals, is extremely, it's almost like a completely different thing to me. It's much, much more difficult, but also can be really rewarding.
Yeah.
And it really depends on the project, on the community, really everything.
Yeah.
So if I'm doing a project, let's say like the project with Project Backboard, it's like, you know, I'm here in Oakland, I'm engaging with the community of Oakland and the kids here. I love working with kids. I thought that was really awesome. And it's like for a good cause that I really like connect with. And I think the fact that it's for kids also allowed me to be my playful self in the design. It's really one of the most difficult things, I think, for me is creating work for the public sphere, because I am trying to be very conscious and empathetic to the infinite ways that the piece can be read and interpreted. And specifically here in Oakland, it's like there is much, I think, a stronger push for work to have a social reason to be in a space.
Yeah.
You know, and to like not just put up things that I just like, you know, in the studio. It is this like completely introspective process where I am synthesizing everything outside and everything that I'm doing outside and things that are happening in the outside world. And then I'm synthesizing it in this like intimate introspective process, and which while allowing myself to discover new things and to just like uncover new and original imagery in different ways and different mark makings. I can like investigate things and research things, and it's all, you know, it's like it's just more introspective. I can address the things that I want to address in the work, and typically that, you know, there's social, I mean there's pretty much in all work there's social meaning, and it's things that are abstract and not necessarily overt. In the public, it's really difficult in the public to get that same overtness, or like not overtness, the opposite of overt, you know.
Well, like the thing about those projects is they're more specific, right? Like, hey, this is something that needs to get done, and this is what we need your help in, right? So there's a little bit more of a, a guideline a little bit. Like, well, you can be creative, but with a certain guideline, because there's a purpose to why you're doing this project, like, right, like Project Blackboard, like, it's to help the kids,
so,
it's to fix the neighborhood.
Yeah, and there's, like, you know, there isn't a directness in the, so when I guess when I say, like, directness, I'm thinking of, like, I have this, like, thought that it is the figurative work that people who are not engaged with the art world that I'm engaged with is wanting to see. So, like, the civilian, you know, the person that's just, you know, working a job, living in a city, I believe that, you know, someone who is not necessarily versed in art is going to be more to gravitate towards directness and imagery and social justice, meaning, you know, social narratives, within work in the public. And I worry that not being direct and being abstract can actually be like a gentrifying force, even, and not connecting with the community that is seeing it all the time.
Yeah.
Granted, that is, like, you know, that's not necessarily true. You know, people can, like, people who, you don't need, like, an art degree to appreciate different types of work.
Right.
I'm just, like, that's kind of, like, an example of, like, the paranoia, almost, of doing public projects. Like, I have a big mural coming up, and it's been, like, almost 5 years in the making, and it stresses me out. It's been, like, it haunts me, because no matter what I do, I know that there is going to be Oaklanders that don't like the work, or, like, are like, what is this?
Right.
You know, like, if you look at, like, both of the shows that I have up right now, I'm super happy with them in the context of a solo exhibition,
right,
of paintings on canvas from my studio.
Yeah.
If I were to make any one of those a mural, it would be a different story, you know. Yeah. It would be, first, it'd be difficult to, it would be super difficult to replicate the process. So pretty, like, the process is way different for a mural. You know, it's often, there's, like, so many people that have a say in it. And ultimately, the people of the community should also have a say in it. And it's just, like, there's just a lot that goes into.
There's a lot more. There's a lot more input other than just your own. When you're doing, like, a solo show for a gallery, it's all that matters is your voice. And then, if you know, and it's like you put it on the walls, like it or don't like it, but it's what I did, right? And then, with something like a mural, lives forever in the public eye. But it's interesting that you,
there's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, though, that you find it more stressful. like I feel like I'm the type of personality that I have, like, if I had to come up, let's say, with 15 paintings for a show by this certain time, I'd be freaking out and, like, stressed and, like, worried and whatever. But it's funny because you seem more relaxed when you talk about having to do something like that than you sound like describing the process of, like, having to do a public project, like a mural or painting a blacktop basketball court.
Yes.
Public would think that that one's supposed to be the fun project.
Yeah, that is completely the opposite. The mural is definitely the stressful one. I mean, if you think about it, it's like you have designs before the mural happens. So there's a ton of people that have seen what the mural is supposed to look like. Yeah. You know, it's not like I'm showing everyone my studio sketches to compare to the actual painting. You know, so it's like, What if the sketch looks better than the actual production? That's not good, you know.
Yeah.
It's, there's a it's definitely more stressful for doing the mural. The painting's in the studio. I mean, ultimately,
yeah,
it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters to me. It matters a lot to me.
Right.
But what I end up showing is a result of like a process of it going through my vetting in the studio and working it out through that process. And that's where I'm the most comfortable. I know I can do it. And and a lot of the best work comes from experimenting and taking risks. Like, the oil pastel paintings, like my process in the studio is, you can't erase. There's no erasing. There's no going back. Once you touch the canvas with one of those oil pastel marks, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
You can't get it off at all. Yeah. There's no erasing. So it's very like, all right, here we go. Like, make that mark. Like, go and do it and work it out and work through it. It's a different level of stress, you know, because sometimes you'll just have a painting in the studio just staring at you and it's like not working, but you have to make it, has to work. Or I mean, if it doesn't work, you have a lot more work to do, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know what, let me ask you this, actually, because that's a good, that leads to a question that I wanted to ask you. So you've had these current two solo shows at Part Two, right? And then you mentioned that you did work for a group show at the San Jose Museum, but that isn't publicly being viewed, but it's there, right? Like, you made it and it's there. And then you currently, mm-hmm. and at the top of the podcast, you mentioned you're currently trying to finish up work for SF MoMA. I'm curious because when you make works for each of these shows, right? I think about, I've seen cases where like there's a show happening in Los Angeles in a museum, and I go see it of a certain artist's work, and then all of a sudden, like by coincidence, I find out they're represented by the gallery in San Francisco, and also I see another exhibition of the same work in San Francisco. But you managed to make all different sets of work for each of these three different venues, I'm assuming. And so mm-hmm. I'm so curious to know what is your process. Like when each of these things come mm-hmm. up, is it like you already have sketches in making already, they're like, ah, this is like would work for this venue, this will work for that venue? Or is it, I mean, to say making them on demand is a little bit more crude, but like you make them for that show, like you're, it's not like they're already sitting done in your studio and then it's like, oh yeah, I'll just ship these four, you know, you're actually making them right up until they're like they're ready to go on view.
Yeah.
Like, how do you decide what will go, what's your theme for each of these different venues?
You know, it's like, it's a process, I think, for me to, like you mentioned, it's like making work on demand. It's the way I think about it is just kind of this connection with thought, feeling, the environment, and myself in its entirety towards the practice. So I have an infinite amount of ideas. Like, I can sit down in right here talking to you and think about a potential body of work. I can think of, you know, 30, 40 paintings right now, because I usually think of a theme, a feeling, an idea, something like that, that will, that can spark into any type of body of work.
Well, actually, what's funny is the current two shows that you have at Part Two, like they're mm-hmm. two solo shows that you have at the same gallery, right? Yep. And but they're completely different and they each have different titles. You know, one is
yep.
you know, one is called the purest air I've ever known, and Freetown Varan.
Yeah.
And so the one in particular, though, like, so the funny thing about your work that I always love is that no matter, they all look different, but they all share similar themes, right? But they look different and unique, and it's one of those things that's amazing in that I could show one show of yours to somebody, like just like looking images online, and they will never know that it's like the same artist who did, like the person who did Domestic Drive is not the same person as Skeleton. Like if I just showed it to somebody, right, which has been really great about your work. And the same is with these two shows, but the one that really stuck out to me was The Purest Air I've Ever Known. And so it's you know, your work for the most part is you know, geometric and abstract, but that one, you know, it's a little bit, it's not as geometric as the one that's like next next to it. And so tell me about that, like tell me about what you were, like your thought process for that, like, and what was in, what inspired that show.
It's pretty much like my thought process behind creating the shows and creating the work, you know. I feel like my practice is really in tune and connected to my life and my thought process. So as I think and navigate the world in all kinds of capacities, in all different levels of small levels, like, you know, around things around my house and my friends and conversations that I have, to like macro world universe theories and things like that, I always, you know, like to make comparisons to things. And I think art really, like, and connecting that to my practice, it becomes really this circle of thought where I think about things and compare them to other things, or and like look at the similarities of life and existence, and kind of look at these like patterns that happen in life, and then I work them out through paintings, because they're often, you know, some of these things you can't really work out in vocabulary with words. It's just like something different, you know, a different way of communicating something that can't be communicated any other way. So for The Purest Air I've Ever Known, that show, that came from making one of those kinds of comparisons. And I was looking at, it's confusing on how it all started, because I was drawing these cut trees a lot, and I was thinking about what that like symbol kind of means, is like our relationship to nature. And I think I was drawing this a lot, and I have to give credit to my friend Brett Flanagan, because I believe he was the one who was like, oh, these look like all of the tree stumps right outside the studio and gallery that have been cut. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, oh yeah, there's all these trees outside that just have been, you know, chopped. And I went outside and I look on the street where my studio is, and sure enough, it's like lined with trees that were, you know, city planted trees that had these gates around them. So they're about, like, you know, kind of 5-6 feet tall, like a metal gate, you know how it is with the, like a park tree with a little fence around it.
Yeah.
So these trees, I guess, have become unwanted in, for some reason, or are doing something that the city doesn't want them to do. I'm not really sure the reason. Maybe they have died and we just, whatever the reason is, they've chopped them to solve the problem. They just kind of have chopped them at right where the fence ends. So there's just these like, it's interesting because I had walked by it so much, and I haven't like made this connection, or like, you know, really acknowledged what was happening around me, even though I walked by it so much. Or maybe I did subconsciously and I just put that into the drawings. But yeah, when Brett made that connection to the drawings I was making, I was like, oh, like, wow. And just like opened up this new motif and this new connection that I wanted to talk about visually. So like the first painting I made for it is actually not in this show. It's actually in the show that's at the ICA in San Jose. So there's actually a piece in that show that shows this transition between motifs. So my ICA show focused around a similar obsession of a motif and it, making connections to the lived experience through that motif. And it was the breeze block, the cement breeze block cement structure. It's hard to describe it if you don't know. It's like the, you know, the block with a little flower design and it has holes in it. It's really popular in like you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly. It's like it's like those very like decorative cement blocks. Yeah, but like they make up a wall. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yes. It's like mid-century modern suburbia type thing.
Yeah, and but you can kind of see like through them, right? Like you, like if,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like I you know, before 2020, 2019, the end of 2019, that was the motif that was really captivating my mind. I was pretty obsessed with it. But in the ICA show, there's a piece that shows this transition between the breeze block and the cut trees. And it's called, what is it called? It's called They Cut the Heads Off Our Trees in the Darkness of Distraction. And that had to do kind of with my relationship to like, they did this thing and like, I was like conveniently like distracted and, you know, I didn't think about it, you know? And I think since then the tree had really become central to how I felt in this lockdown moment where in many different functions, the trees, both symbolize like resilience in this way. I've been taking photos around town actually of trees that have been cut by the city, in similar ways. And it's, once you start noticing it, it really becomes like fixated in your mind, you know, and you like start to notice it everywhere.
Yeah.
And a lot of the trees, even though they were cut in this like completely vital, like spot, you know, like if you chop a tree, it's dead. You just killed the whole thing. But, you know, their root systems are still there and they're still rooted and they still try to grow. So you see these cut, these like really like, I consider them like monuments of death because they're just kind of there and dead. And
yeah,
it's really like, it's like, it also shows the, our disconnect with nature and city planning. It's like really we couldn't like anticipate how a tree would grow in the city right here in this little plot. Like,
yeah, well, isn't
you don't know trees enough.
Well, I was gonna say, like, you made that comment about our disconnect with nature, because if I remember correctly, you know, the whole concept of having trees in a city, right? Like if you're walking down a sidewalk, mm-hmm, and there's like a tree planted, you know, with a little like,
yeah,
like the whole reason is because they knocked down a bunch of trees and natural landscape to build the city. And then at one point, the turn of the century, people were like, oh, I feel like we need more nature and green around, right? Let's build a park.
Totally.
Or let's build a tree. Like, let's plant a tree. And none of those trees are like native to that area, but it's just like there to provide this like facade that like, well, there's still some nature.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the fact that these same trees that were planted for that purpose are just like willful, like willingly, like just cut and then left behind.
Yeah, and it's exactly, it's just like, it just shows so much, the whole process. And then especially like, okay, we've made this mistake in like city planning or whatever, We're not understanding how trees grow, you know, like, okay, all of that said, I mean, why don't you at least like remove the stumps or something? Yeah. Or like, I it's like, but the thing is, maybe they know that trees are actually resilient, you know, and mm-hmm. what is actually happening in most of these trees is that there's small branches that grow off the side and start new, mm-hmm. you know. And I've been, you know, I do a lot of like houseplant gardening. I have a lot of like propagating plants and things like that. And it always fascinates me so much how resilient plants are, you know, like you can cut, like a leaf can cut off of a bush and float down a river and grow roots and start a whole new bush, you know, like at some faraway place. It's, you know, you cut a plant at something somewhere where you think that there's no way that it could survive, and sure enough, it sprouts two more leaves, like, out of nothing. So I've been making a lot of connections to the resilience of nature, to the resilience of humans, and in a lot of work, especially as the lockdown had progressed and we got into more, you know, questions of social justice and Black Lives Matter and the killing of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and all of that, you know, during that moment, the trees really started for me to take more of a figurative position, you know, like they're kind of like the subjects. They're kind of like as close as I've wanted to like come to really to like talk about the figure, to talk about the human body in a way. But yeah, so there's, I make a lot of different connections to those, like those, through those trees, through the cut tree motif, and the resilience of nature and how foolish we as humans are, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting too about a tree, right? You talk about resilience. It's like, that's like one of the most resilient plants around, that, you know, aside from a weed, I guess. But like, but tree's pretty. But you know, the tree, you can cut its branches, it'll grow back. You know, the leaves will fall, they'll grow back. You know, you can like carve into it, whack at it, it'll still stand. And then even when you cut it down, for the most part, it's still there. The roots are still embedded in the, like, you still have to physically pull the roots out for it to truly, mm-hmm. truly be dead and gone. And I feel like, yeah. in terms of like the connection with everything that's going on and resiliency, like, I mean, what's like, that's like the biggest symbol of it all, is like, you can cut me down as much as you want, but you, like, as long as the roots are still there, I'm still here. And I still still have a purpose, you know, like, it's funny. It's almost like a connection to that. What's that book? The Giving Tree, whatever. Right. Like even when it's a stump, it still has a use. You can still see it. You can still sit on it. It could still grow into something new, you know, like, it still has a purpose. It's not completely gone. And what's funny is that, you know, the city obviously is the people that sent out the public works department, probably, right, to cut down these trees,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
And it's obvious they're doing it because either it's a nuisance or either because they made a mistake or whatever it is. But no matter what they do, until they like completely devastate the foundation, they can't get rid of that stump. It's still going to be an eyesore.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not like they've cut it with this, like, I feel like it's not like it's cut with this understanding that it's, oh, it has its roots still. It's still going to grow. Right. It's definitely like this destructive, like, oh, this is not serving us the way we want it to anymore, so right. we're just gonna cut it and right. no one's gonna care, right. you know,
right?
You know, for whatever reason, you know, there's trees on 17th Street. I feel like they cut there's really beautiful trees here in downtown Oakland and on 17th Street.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of was like the whole charm of the street. It was like actually a very unique thing, and not every other street had that. you know, kind of like this little canopy almost of trees, and they cut them. They cut them, and I really feel like it was for some arbitrary, like, to make sure, like, the businesses that were behind the trees, like, their signs were, like, visible or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because, like, they just, it's coincidentally, they're, like, also trying to sell, like, real estate on that whole, like, block, like, one side of the block for, like, retail real estate. So I'm, like, really, like, and they left the stumps, of course, so there's just these...
Right. Like, what's more like of an eyesore, the grown trees or the stumps?
Yeah. It's like, this shows where we are, you know, in terms of a truer understanding of living on Earth and living in a, like, cooperative way with Earth. I feel as though humans just, you know, we have a chip on our shoulder and think that we're kind of above everything else. When in actuality, it's like, no, like, we just are ignorant and are choosing certain aspects of societal living over, like, maintaining a deeper connection with the actual world around us, you know?
Yeah. I mean, these fires going on are, like, some of the biggest proof of that,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And look, that's exactly the point, because I was just reading that they're now, like, California now moving forward is taking indigenous, like, controlled burning methods, because, you know, the indigenous people of California were maintaining the land and had a deeper connection with the land, so they developed, like, systems of controlled burns to burn off, you know, like, areas to prevent, like, large-scale wildfires, which is a tactic that I guess California, as the Western world, didn't want to do. But I don't know. It's just one of those stories where I'm just like, huh, interesting. So the people who were, like, much more connected to the land had already developed methods to maintain the land while we pretty much just paved over it.
yeah, exactly.
And then you just thought that that was it, you know, but it obviously isn't it, because, you know, people always say, like, humans are going to destroy the Earth, and I think that's so silly, because there's no, I mean, humans can damage the Earth for sure, but ultimately, if we damage the Earth, we're the ones that are going to be killed off.
Right.
The Earth will regenerate itself and become something new and better. That's what it's been doing this whole time. You know, it's been hit by a fucking meteor.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Right. Right. Wasn't the idea when the meteor hits, like, scientifically, they used to talk about, like, for millions of years, the air is, like, filled basically with, like, not, like, with all this toxic stuff, and then eventually out of 2 million years or whatever, how many years, millions of years later, it cleared up, basically, because then otherwise we wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, miss me with that. Like,
yeah.
You know, I'm also, like, a super Capricorn, so I'm very connected. I feel very earthbound. I actually have, like, arguments about with people who want to, like, colonize Mars, because I think that's just
it's really
stupid.
Yeah,
it's just, well, I mean, that's not to get super off track, but, like, colonizing Mars is, like, that's something of a super advanced society that has everything together at home, and that's just not the case. Like, if we had everything together and living symbiotically with the Earth and everything was chill, sure, go to Mars, whatever.
Right.
So people are like, oh, Earth is going to be, like, habitable. Everyone needs to go to Mars. I'm like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, there's no Earth. There's just no way Earth can get as bad as Mars is already. Like, I would live in a Mad Max, like, Blade Runner Earth over Mars. Like, Mars is still fucking Mars. It doesn't even have an atmosphere.
Right. But you know, if you pitch it the right way, Mize, you know, real estate could be booming up there, you know?
Well, that's honestly good. Let whoever wants to go to Mars, go ahead and go to Mars. I'm going to hold it down here on Earth, and I'll be planting trees in this firestorm mess. But, yeah, that's how I feel about that.
Yeah. So before I let you go, I wanted to have you plug slash talk about the work that you're going to have at SF MoMA, because I think by the time I release this podcast, these two shows at part two are going to close. But then the next thing is your SF MoMA show. So I guess, like, how did that come to fruition? And is it a show, or is it like a project, or like what is it exactly?
It's a project. It's more of a project. You know, it's as much as I would love to be like, oh yes, my show at SF MoMA. It's definitely more of a project, part of the, it actually has evolved a lot. It was a mural initiative at first, but since, discussed that, I think paintings would be a better, look for me, and a better representation of the way I work. It's been a tough time this summer, and dealing with some actions of SF MoMA, and you know, being on working with them, you know, like this project was coming together like maybe like a week before like George Floyd and the situations that followed. But yeah, it was tough, you know, it was tough to decide to even do the show, really. It was hard. It was a lot of introspection. You know, it's been a dream of mine for years. Maybe the longest art-related goal I've ever had was to be in specifically SF MoMA.
Well, why specifically SF MoMA?
Well, because SF MoMA played a very important role in my life. Just because I moved to San Francisco in 2011, and I'm a fan of museums. I love seeing art. I love going to, you know, galleries and looking at paintings, and I think when I moved to San Francisco, it was my first like big move anywhere to a new city. I fell just in love with the place. When I went to SF MoMA, I really was like, this is the museum. This is like where I get to see these things that I've always wanted to see, you know, in person. This is my place now, you know, this is the place that I'm going to be going. You know, I felt really connected to the museum, and, you know, I've seen a lot of works there that have been super influential to like my development. You know, I love the museum so much that I followed them throughout their closing. I went to the last, not the last day, but like I went to the museum like the last week it was open before it remodeled. Spent a lot of time at the Christian Marclay, the clock piece, that was a 24-hour piece that was a super influential experience for me. And yeah, I watched them. I literally watched that live stream building of the museum that they had. Like I watched it. I don't know. Do you remember that? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, I know exactly. When
so when they were doing the construction of the museum, they had that like live stream of it, and I watched it because I was super excited. I was really, really excited because I loved seeing art, and that's what that space represented for me, is like the pinnacle of seeing art, you know, and seeing art from all over, all throughout time, from different places. I loved it. Yeah, it's, you know, I followed them through the construction, and I followed them through employment. You know, when I saw the museum was actually finally opening, I was like on it with trying to get hired there. I was really, it came at a very interesting time too, because I didn't know what to do. I had just finished this internship at the San Francisco Arts Commission, and I really thought that I was going to get a job there, and I didn't. And after that, I was like, oh no, like, how do I like do something within my interest of art? You know, I didn't go to school for art, and I was really like hoping that the SFAC would, I could do something there. So I was like, oh man, do I need to go to grad school? Like, how do I get into like art, you know? Like,
yeah.
But it was really difficult for me to work somewhere that didn't have to do with art. Even though that's not what I studied, I should have, if I cared so much about that, I probably should have studied it. But, so yeah, SF MoMA ended up really being that for me, you know, and I remember the interview process. I was like trying to be so on it. I was like really trying to show up, and I did enough to get the job. Yeah, and then, you know, I worked at SF MoMA for 4 years.
Yeah.
And now to
go from that story to then now, like, your work is going to be on exhibit there. Like, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But I can't tell that story without talking about the process of it getting there, and the work that like Taylor Brandon did, and NNA, and Ujinde, and you know, when that happened, I was just so disappointed. Yeah. You know, it was like, it was really rough, because I just felt really dumb. You know, like, I would always be trying to, like, get everyone excited about exhibitions, you know? Like, I know, like, the museum is not, like, as good as it can be, you know?
Yeah.
But from working there, I also know it's compartmentalized, you know? Like, right. I know that the departments don't have that much communication with each other.
Right.
And, like, you can have, like, a curatorial department who has, like, an incremental view of progression, and like, you know, is working on these long time scales, like, you know, years in advance for these like inclusionary initiatives. But like, you know, it's tough, because like, I was like, yeah, like, I'm out here like, you know, promoting shows and telling people, oh, like, how much they should go to see Soft Power, and like,
yeah,
these like really great shows that were a new way of, you know, showing artists of color and, you know, non-traditionally, or like just not white male artists.
Right.
You know, the Soft Power show was great, and right, it did that in such a smart way. And, you know, I think the division was already too far gone at that point, because, you know, no one was really not many people I knew in my circles were excited like I was, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, like I think it's like the same situation I was in too, is that I love that museum. And you know, like you, I mean, I'm from Southern California, and part of the reason of me moving here was because, you know, I went to that museum and I was like, yeah, this is where I want to work. I'm going to go to grad school.
Yeah.
And this is the part that I want to work.
Yeah.
So, and so my baby's crying in the background.
Oh, I know. Congrats, by the way, again.
Thanks. And so, you know, and I, you know, to tell, you know, I don't talk about it much on the podcast, but I'll say I work there. You know, that's how I met you. You worked there, and we run into each other there. And I work, you know, I work in the registration department, and that's a department where like we're so focused on just like we got to take care of the art. Like it doesn't matter what art comes in, we have to take care of the art, right? But
totally.
And it's one of those things where when stuff like you're so focused on that, and then when you come up for air and check out what the other departments are doing, and check out like how the public is reacting or what they're putting on the floor, and you realize like. You get disappointed when you hear those, like what they did Taylor, you know, and it's one of those things. It's so funny because it runs so parallel to what's going on in the rest of this country too. Right. Where it's, I don't criticize the museum because I hate it. It's because I love it and I want it to be better.
Exactly.
And be a better place. And that was kind of the sentiment, I think, for a lot of people there. And even for people who are like members or just visitors that love going there in the community, is just kind of like, what the hell, man? Like, you know, you guys, and also like, I think sometimes the stigma of West Coast museums sometimes is that, oh, that's something that happens on East Coast museums where they're very traditional, right? The West Coast, we're a little bit more liberal than that. And what happened this past summer with SF MoMA and the drama that came out of it was like, it showed everyone like, nah, it happens everywhere. And SF MoMA is like not an exception. And so that was, it was a lot to go through. I think just like one, the acceptance of like, damn, I can't believe that's a place that happens. And then two, like finding the motivation to like fight for it to be a better place, you know?
I know. And that's the thing. I just want it to be good. I really do. And I want to like really try my, like do whatever I can do to like help make that motion possible.
Yeah.
I understand it's hard because there's this genuine sentiment of like, you know, of they're built on this like, you know, problematic circumstances and they're inherently bad and we need to abolish museums. You know, that is like, you know, it's a sentiment that's understandable.
Right.
I think for me, what it comes down to when I think about even just the visual of burning down a museum, I'm just like, oh, what about the art? You know, what about the paintings? Like, how are we going to see them? You know what I mean? Like, it's like people will ask me, like, you know, like, why do I, like, this is like over summer, you know, this my family, my collective is on the front lines of the prosecution of the, you know, museum. And it's like, why do I care so much about the museum, you know? Yeah. And it's not necessary. It's not the structure. It's not the building. It's, you know, it's the art and it's the, I want to see that. Like,
yeah.
And I think the goal is to make it a place that to make SF MoMA live up to their own mission statement. You know,
right.
The goal is the thing that's like so interesting is that it's so in the museum's capacity to right the wrongs that have been like, I don't know. Maybe I'm naive
No, I think it's like
it's such a big space.
I feel like with museums like that, it is possible. I think sometimes people say, when you say things like that, that you're naive, but it's not really true. I think they're just trying to throw you off. The reality is like, no, there's a lot of money behind this place. These are very solvable problems. You just have to be willing to do it. You know, I think it's an unsolvable problem if like half the building burned down and your insurance didn't cover it. And no matter what, you can't fix it. You know, like that's like, you know, but no, like, I think you're right. I think they can solve it. They can do it.
It's just like it has to. Yeah, they have to.
Well, I think they're stepping in the right direction by, including someone like you. You know, like somebody who's been in this in the Bay Area community for art community for a long time now. At this point, you know, and you're like you know. I think that museums like that. I think it. It's so funny. This was like the biggest criticism I made of like museums like SF MoMA, is that due to the pandemic, right? They can't rely on tourism and tourism to sell tickets, right? And they realize that, and they know that the tourism is going to take even at least maybe 2 to 3 more years before it gets back to normal, right? So they have to rely on the community, like people who already live here, and it's so funny to me because they're like, how do we get them to come here? And I'm like, how is that the question? Shouldn't have that been the one thing you mastered first before you figured out how to get tourists to the door? Because they're right here. They're like, they live in your backyard. And and so now they're doing what I felt they should have always been doing. And that was inviting local artists that live and breathe and work in the city and the rest of the Bay Area. And invite them long ago to do projects like what you're doing. And then Liz Hernandez, who I know is one of the other artists, and then the Twin Murals Company, I think, is like the other project that they're doing. Like, those are people who've already been here doing a lot of different things in the community and for various art galleries and art spaces. And I think the step in the right direction is having invited all of you to do that. That's the smartest thing I think they've done in a long time. Smarter than opening a new building, to be honest. You know, because they should have done that before the new building.
And honestly, like, I think there's going to be a lot of changes, you know, it's also interesting of my, like, position, you know, as an ex-employee and as a current working artist. And also part of my collective, I've been really actually blessed, you know, to see all of a lot of different perspectives, and to have conversations with a lot of people that I felt were listening now, you know, like it was, you know, quite an honor to have I don't know, just people listening.
Yeah.
And, you know, taking notes and addressing and following up, and people that I didn't think would ever care to, you know, to hear advice from me and to hear my story and to tell them why that this really needs to be fixed, you know?
Yeah.
And now like what you're saying about the museum being closed, it's interesting because it's almost like a beautiful aspect of something so dark is that they really do have to, you know, have to sit with it.
Yeah.
And I feel like now the staff is really holding, you know, management to do things, you know, and the union is very active and there's a lot of things in motion. And from what I've seen, I am optimistic on the changes, some of the changes that are going on, and some of the people that I know personally that are like taking control of things. But again, we'll see how that plays out because, you know, I'm a generally optimistic person. So we'll see how that optimism plays out. But, you know,
yeah.
I'm hopeful. Like, it's been a lot. I've been thinking about this a lot. So much so that it's really, I'd say, kind of maybe set me back a little bit with my shows, my two solo shows, you know, having this happening through July and June, which were supposed to be big work months for the show. I was also making these two very large paintings and dealing with whether or not I want to show these paintings at the museum that I've always kind of been so close connected to. That was a very, you know, it was a moment that allowed me to renegotiate my dreams, you know, like why I don't really have many, I don't really have any like direct dreams like that, or like direct, like, I want to see my art in this place. I don't really think like that, except for this one instance with SF MoMA. Like, I've always kind of wanted my work. So it's like very interesting that, like, this is like my one, like, weird, like, little, like, actual tactile, like, goal. And then right the moment where it happened, like the week to where that goal was realized after years of manifestation since I had come to the Bay Area in 2011, it finally happened, and then it was immediately, like, pulled away from the joy, you know? Like, the joy was pretty much just sucked out of the situation to where I didn't even tell my collective yet, because, like, I wanted to, like, really flesh it out to, like, be like, listen, like, I'm doing a show, you know? And it was supposed to be, like, exciting, but then, you know, I had to tell them after all of this stuff happened.
Yeah.
So, like, we're formulating an offense, if, like, to hold the museum accountable, and then I'm like, oh, by the way, guys, like, I had a project with them. And they're like, what? Okay. You know, it was like,
yeah, twist. There's a plot twist, it wasn't, guys.
Yeah, plot twist. It was like not the reception I thought it would, you know, not the reception I thought it would be. But that was like on me. Like, I had to like sit down and think about, like, why did I get that? Like, is this even a goal? Like, so what happens when I have this goal? Like, what happens next?
Like, right. I feel like and I think that it's fair to say that you could still fight the fight that you guys are fighting, and at the same time still have that goal, you know, like still be able to accomplish that goal, you know. It's, you know, it goes,
well,
back to,
yeah,
right? Like, it's okay. Like, I don't think you have to, like, sacrifice one for the other. Like, they both, I feel,
exactly,
like, can happen.
Well, I mean, that's literally like where my logic came to, is that doing this show, like, I didn't, because the question of, like, whether or not I would, the question was, like, am I going to have to boycott this show and not do this show? But I thought about it, and, you know, what positive actions would come from me not doing the show compared to if I did do the show?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking then, what is my goal, you know? And I think that is where, you know, I was less extreme, I guess, because my goal is not to abolish the museum.
Right.
That's just not what my goal is. I love seeing art. And I think the goal is for that is to be a better, more equitable and inclusive representation of culture, because that's what museums claim to be, is this arbiter of culture. And just like movements of equality, it's not like anyone's saying that the museum should be all one person, like one type of people. It should be an inclusive representation of what people are doing, you know, like, but also it's a modern art museum. So there is space for that, in my opinion. Absolutely. You know, there is space to maintain a prestige, you know, like I think about the curators and how, like, I deeply do respect them, but I know that they are in the art history vacuum, you know?
Yeah.
And their peers are like the Pompidou and New York MoMA and, you know, the Tate Modern. So like they're in conversation with their international peers, it seems like. And I think, you know, initiatives to maintain a connection to the space that they're in has just been lost or just never really there to begin with. And if we create like a more equitable museum, I think that is like, you know, our goal is where we should be going with it, in my opinion, you know?
Absolutely.
So
yeah,
with that, I'm like deeply feel much more powerful in a position where I'm inside the museum and talking to people and working with them, compared to being outside against the museum. You know, I think that I have a very similar way of looking at politics in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if we want to burn the system down, we have to engage with it first.
Yeah.
You know,
sure. Absolutely.
It's like, if we really want to burn it down, which I would consider as just a phrase that means drastic reform. Yeah.
Before I let you go, man, so when does that show at SFOMA open?
That's a good question.
TBD, right? Whenever the pandemic ends.
I think you should ask London Breed.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let's hope we see it.
Yeah.
Let's hope we see it soon. You know, I think supposedly, according to the mayor of San Francisco, the museums can open as early as late September. So let's hope that yeah. So I think she announced it earlier this week. Let's hope that that sticks, because I think we've had a false alarm before. So let's hope that sticks, and let's hope by like the fall, the beginning of the fall, that we can see your work.
Great. Yeah, that would be great. And it was fun talking to you, and
yeah.
I hope we can keep the museum accountable and continue doing what we're doing.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, man, no problem. Right. See ya.
See ya, man.
All right, that's it for today. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Musée for coming on. Learn more about Musée and his work by visiting his website at museesucé.com. You can also check out his work on the Part 2 Gallery website at part2gallery.com. Learn more about the Bay Area Walls commissions at SFMOMA that include works by Musée and other local artists by visiting the SFMOMA website. Finally, please be sure to visit the podcast website at artscenepc.com. Till next time, everyone.